Okay, this is Professor Tufano, and this is part two of, I think, three parts of chapter 12, Managing Conflict in the book Interplay. This is the 13th edition, and I'm starting this, I'm starting on page 371 for this second part. So, conflict styles. It says here most people have default styles for handling conflict. Characteristic approaches that they take when their needs appear to be incompatible with what others want. Although our habitual styles work sometimes, they may not work at all, they may not work at all or in other situations. So I mentioned earlier in the context of conflict and work, and how in a conflict that is work-related between consumers and employees, not necessarily between two employees, but if we just think about comparing our conflict styles, if we are in customer service, any type of retail, any type of environment where you are responsible for providing a service or products to consumers, if you are in that job vocation zone, you have some experience with dealing with difficult customers. And so what style do you use to resolve conflict and manage conflict with difficult customers is not the same kind of strategies or tactics that you should or would use when trying to resolve conflict with an intimate, someone that you are in relationship with. So again, even though conflict occurs in these various contexts, so as an example, we could use the context of customer service conflict. We could use the context of you being an employee and having conflict with someone at work. And we could use the context of having conflict with an intimate person. And again, an intimate could be a friend, it could be a family member, or it could be a romantic partner. And you could see even in those three contexts, the strategies and tactics that you'll use to handle conflict, whether it's managing or resolving it, could and should be different, for sure. So maybe in your personal life, if you're having a difficult relationship with a sibling, you can go tell them to screw off or use the French version. But if you're in a customer service environment where it's your job to provide a product or service and meet the needs of a customer, when things get difficult, you can't tell them to screw off or to, you just can't do that. So conflict styles, defined here as a characteristic approach that one takes when their needs appear to be incompatible with what others want, should vary depending upon the context and the type of relationship that we have with the other person we're in conflict with. It says, what styles do you typically use to deal with a conflict? And they give a couple here, an example, a hypothetical example, using Chris and Pat to manage a problem. It says, Chris and Pat have been roommates for several years. Chris is a soccer fan, loves watching the game with friends at every opportunity. Their apartment has a pretty big TV, but it's owned, and it's owned by Chris in the living room, and it's become a regular gathering spot for viewing. But Pat doesn't mind watching an occasional game, but is annoyed by what seems to be endless TV watching and endless house guests. Chris thinks he ought to be able to watch his TV whenever he wants with whomever he wants. Here are five ways they could handle their conflict, representing five different conflict styles. So they list avoidance, accommodation, competition, compromise, and collaboration. And then on page 372, there's an interesting figure, 12.2, talks about conflict styles. So avoidance, Chris and Pat don't discuss the issue. Accommodation, Pat gives in. Competition, Chris tries to persuade Pat that watching soccer is better than anything else they could watch. Compromise, the roommates agree to split the difference. Chris gets to watch any game he wants as long as the friends don't come over. So Pat gets relative peace and quiet. And collaboration, Chris and Pat brainstorm and discover alternatives. For example, they decide that the fans could watch some games together at local sports bars, and they also realize that if Chris's friends could pitch in a modest sum, they could get a bigger TV. Pat also suggests that he and Chris could watch more non-sports together. So those are some interesting ways with this hypothetical situation about friends coming over and TV watching, although I don't think it would be that unusual of a conflict, especially if you do have roommates or live with a roommate, or if you live in your parents' basement or garage. Maybe there are some, it could be some issues with friends coming over and when they come over and how long they stay and then what you watch and how loud you are and what are some of those responsibilities, who makes a mess, who cleans up the mess, those kind of things. So these conflict styles, these are things that probably all of us use depending upon the specific context and depending upon the specific kind of relationship. So we're all going to avoid at times, we'll all accommodate, we'll all compete at times, we'll all compromise at times, and then we will all collaborate at times. Again, it depends upon the context and depends upon the kind of relationship that you have. Obviously, collaboration is an important component of resolving conflict for sure. But so let's talk more in depth about the definition of each of these five different ways to process conflict, and then we'll get a little bit more detail. It says avoidance, and the book calls it lose-lose. Avoidance occurs when people ignore or stay away from the conflict. It can be physical, steering clear of a friend after having an argument, or conversational, changing the topic. Avoidance generally reflects a pessimistic attitude about the conflict. Avoiders usually believe it's easier to put up with the status quo than face the problem head-on and try to solve it. Partners of self-silencers, that's an interesting way to describe people, self-silencers. Partners of self-silencers report more frustration and discomfort when dealing with the avoiding partner than with those who face conflict more constructively. Chronic misunderstandings, resentments, and disappointments pile up and contaminate the emotional climate. For that reason, we can say that avoiders have a low concern for both for their own needs and for the interests of others, who are also likely to suffer from the unaddressed issues. Moving on to on page 373, accommodation. They call this lose-win. Accommodation occurs when we allow others to have their own way rather than asserting our own point of view. The motivation of an accommodator plays a significant role in this style's effectiveness. If accommodation is genuine act of kindness, generosity of or love, then chances are good that it will enhance the relationship. So you could say, well, out of my love and concern for you, I will just accommodate you, and then I will then my needs or my desires, my expectations, I will give in and accommodate you. So I think this kind of makes sense. If at least appears that it is a genuine act of kindness, generosity of love, or love, it will enhance the relationship. However, the inverse would not be true. And it says, however, people are far less appreciative of those who habitually use this style to play the role of the martyr, of the bitter complainer, of the whiner, or the saboteur. So does the person accommodating or giving in, you could say it that way, are they doing it so that they can take on the role of the martyr, the complainer, or the whiner? So, but in functional, intimate, satisfying relationships, there is a sense that there are times when giving in to the other person's needs, desires, or wants, or expectations does enhance the relationship. But when it feels out of balance, when one party feels that they're always the one giving in or accommodating, then it creates some inequity in the relationship, and that will further create barriers to communication, and then, of course, makes it difficult to be intimate with someone when you have a sense that the relationship isn't balanced or fair. On page 374, we'll talk about competition, and they have an interesting cartoon, which I've always liked. It's been in the different versions of the book. It's in the upper left-hand corner of page 374. You should refer to it. It has a picture of two dogs dressed in suits sitting in a bar and drinking, it looks like. And it says, looks like one's talking to the other. And it says, it's not enough for us to succeed. Cats must also fail. So that's kind of a funny way to talk about this competition strategy or approach to managing and resolving conflict. It says, the flip side of accommodation is competition, a win-lose approach to conflict that involves high concern for self and low concern for the others. Just as competition can develop an economy, it can sometimes develop a relationship. This researcher found that some men and women in dating relationships use competition to enrich their interaction. For example, some found satisfaction by competing in play. Could be racquetball, basketball, golf, Scrabble, those kind of things. In achievements, who gets the better job or the higher grade? These satisfied couples developed a shared narrative that defined competition as a measure of regard. So that's kind of interesting, to compete. If you believe your way is the best one, you may feel justified in trying to control the situation. But it's likely that the other person won't view your bid for control so charitably. The dark side of competition that it often breeds aggression. Sometimes aggressiveness is obvious, but other times it could be more subtle. So now we talk about passive-aggressive and direct-aggressive behavior. And that's page 374 and 375. And I do recommend you take a deeper look, if possible, to even go beyond what is talked about in the text, because passive aggressiveness is unfortunately very common in relationships, and direct aggression in some relationships can be common, or at least it could be a way that partners respond to conflict. And partners need to be careful because aggression could lead to physical attacks. And so we need to be aware of that. There's still, unfortunately, domestic abuse, romantic partners physically abusing one another is still a huge cultural, societal problem for sure. And it often comes from some type of unresolved conflict, or at least it involves some unresolved conflict. Okay, passive aggressiveness occurs when a communicator expresses dissatisfaction in a disguised manner. So, versus direct aggression, which there's no disguise to it. It's obvious aggression. But passive aggressiveness occurs when a communicator expresses dissatisfaction in a disguised manner. Passive aggressiveness can take the form of crazy making. I like that term. Tactics designed to punish another person without direct confrontation. Crazy making takes its name from the effect such as behavior usually has on its target. There are a number of crazy making ways to deal with conflict. One is through guilt. Never mind, I'll do it myself, blah. Go ahead and have a good time. Don't worry about me. Another crazy maker is when someone agrees with you to your face but has a different agenda behind your back. That sounds like something that could happen at work. Some passive aggressiveness is nonverbal, a roll of the eyes, the old eye roll, a pained expression, or a disdainful laugh can get a message across. Whatevs. If the target of these messages asks about them, the passive aggressor can always deny the conflict exists. Even humor, especially sarcasm, gee, I can't wait to spend the weekend with your folks, can be used as passive aggressiveness. And that is true. Sarcasm is is definitely a concern in many relationships, that the partners, especially when one partner wants to talk about something that is somewhat serious or important to them, and the other person responds sarcastically or with sarcasm, which is normally another form of hidden anger, typically. Now, sarcasm, in its proper context, may not come across as some type of dysfunctional interaction. So sometimes when friends appreciate each other's sarcasm or wit or cutting personality, then it may have enhance the interaction between the partners. But when it comes to areas of points of conflict, especially when one party is trying to have a more serious conversation about problems and solutions, if one partner constantly responds sarcastically, you could see where that's going to create an additional conflict to pile on to the original one. It says, sometimes saying nothing is a crazy maker weapon. So when silence isn't golden, it says here, silence is golden, says the well-known maxim. There are certain times when keeping resentment to yourself could be smart, but the silent treatment, purposely acting aloof and non-responsive when unhappy, is anything but golden. It's actually a form of passive aggressiveness that's used as a weapon in interpersonal conflicts. So maybe you know of people who use silence as a weapon to communicate passive aggressively during conflicts. And it says the dark side of communication. And in some cases, being silent is smart, especially when trying to moderate emotions, especially strong emotions. But if it's constantly used as a weapon, it really is creates additional dysfunction within the relationship. It says if you're staying quiet during a conflict because you don't want to say something you regret later, that's fine. But if you're strategically punishing loved ones by not talking to them, recognize that you're probably harming yourself as well as the other person, and you're likely damaging the relationship as well. I totally agree with that one. Okay, we're moving on. We're on page 375 to direct aggression. A directly aggressive communicator lashes out to attack the source of displeasure. And this one researcher, Infante, identified 9 types of aggression. Character attacks, competent attacks, competence attacks, physical appearance attacks, maledictions, wishing the other's bad fortune, teasing, ridicule, threats, swearing, and nonverbal emblems such as fist waving, arm waving. And if you think about social media, oftentimes you will see these used. I look at Twitter, which I've described as a garbage can, but I still look in that can on a regular basis. And a lot of times the people on there will use these 9 particularly to attack others that they disagree with. So they have a different opinion of an issue, and instead of just saying we agree to disagree and we have a different opinion, they then go to the next step and they are directly aggressive. They attack the person's character. They attack their competence. They attack their physical appearance. This often happens with women when there is some type of conflict or some disagreement, that people then will attack their looks. Wishing the other bad fortune. You see this a lot, especially with political identity, where somebody is sick and the other person says, I hope they'll die. Those kind of things. Teasing, ridicule, threats, swearing, and then nonverbal emblems are hard to do on the interweb, but I guess the emoticons could be considered nonverbal emblems. It says, like all types of relational communication, direct aggression has both a verbal and nonverbal dimension. The results of direct aggression can have a severe impact on the target. There's a significant connection between verbal aggression and physical aggression. So the idea is that oftentimes prior to someone physically hurting another person, they will be verbally aggressive towards them. I'm not sure the connection. I don't think there's a. There is some type of connection, but I'm not convinced that there's some direct relationship, because the vast majority of verbal disagreements do not lead to physical attacks. And so, just using basic reason and logic, you could say, well, yes, sometimes people become verbally abusive, verbally aggressive, and then they end up acting out physically. But the vast majority of people who are verbally aggressive or verbally abusive do not physically attack other people. So I'm not so sure there's some great correlation between those two ideas. It says, we're going to page 376. moving on to compromise. Negotiated, they call this lose-lose. So a compromise gives both people at least some of what they want, although both sacrifice a part of their goals. People usually settle for a compromise when it seems that partial satisfaction is the best that they can hope for. It's the best that they can hope for. Although compromise may be better than losing everything, this approach hardly seems to deserve the positive image it often has. They talk about this specific book, but I'm moving on. It says, most of us are surrounded by the results of bad compromises. Consider a common example. The conflict between one person's desire to smoke a cigarette and the other person's desire for clean air, at least in that within that smoking range, right? The win-lose outcome on this issue is obvious. Either the smoker abstains or the non-smoker gets to smell the smoke, okay? Neither option is very satisfying. But a compromise in which the smoker gets to enjoy a cigarette or must retreat outdoors, and which the non-smoker still must inhale some of the fumes, hardly may feel like accommodating a successful accommodation. Both sides have lost considerable amount of comfort and goodwill. Of course, the cost in these other compromises is, of course, the cost involved in other compromises are greater. So, you're talking about an issue here between someone who wants to smoke and someone that doesn't want to smell the smoke, right? So I don't know if it's a great example, but certainly one party can say, well, this compromise is too much, and this negotiation is really a lose-lose. And so I think that's kind of the main point of it. But the truth is, it says, the costs involved in other compromises are even greater. And so that is one that involves people, and especially deeply connected people. It says, for example, if a divorced couple haggles over custody in a way that leaves them bitter and emotionally scars their children, it's hard to say that anybody has, quote, won, no matter what the outcome is. And unfortunately, many of you know this and may have come from situations where there was a dissolution of a relationship regarding moms or dads or stepdads or stepmoms or those kind of things, and know how painful and hurtful those kind of conflicts, that's the ultimate conflict when a serious relationship dissolves. But the compromise there between both parties that are hurt and angry and struggling to make some sense out of the relationship, oftentimes one party wants it, the other party doesn't. And so one party is still trying to figure out why the other party wants to leave them, especially when it involves children. So it says here, it's hard to say that anybody has, quote, won, no matter really what the outcome is. Some compromises do leave people satisfied. They use an example of you and a seller of a used car might settle on a price that is between what the seller wants, the seller was asking, and what they wanted to pay, between the buyer wanted to pay. Although neither person got exactly what they wanted, the outcome still leaves them both satisfied. The seller gets rid of the vehicle within their price acceptable price range, and the purchaser gets something that they want, which is the vehicle, within their budget. So that kind of does make sense. It says here that these two researchers found that college students College students with a strong focus on intimacy goals were likely to engage in open discussion and compromise, show concern for their partners, and seek social support. And importantly, they were likely to be successful in resolving conflict. When compromises are satisfying and successful, it might be more accurate to categorize them as the final style, which the book discusses, which is collaboration. Okay, so we'll talk about collaboration before we take a break and finish up this section. It says, collaboration seeks win-win solutions to conflict. It involves a high degree of concern for both self and others, with the goal of solving problems not my way or your way, but our way. In the best case, collaborating can lead to win-win outcomes. In a win-win problem solving, the goal is to find a solution that satisfies the needs of everyone. Not only do partners avoid trying to win at each other's expense, but they also believe that working together can provide a solution in which all the goals to reach all the goals without needing to compromise. And then they have a few examples of collaboration. A boss and his employees get into a conflict over scheduling. The employees often want to shift the hours they're scheduled to work so that they can accommodate personal needs, whereas the boss needs to be sure that the operation is fully staffed at all times. After the discussion, they arrive at a solution that satisfies everyone. The boss works up a monthly master schedule indicating hours to which each employee is responsible for being on the job. Employees are free to trade hours amongst themselves as long as the operation is fully staffed. That would be a classic problem solving. Practically, I'm not so sure how that would work, because once you then shift to that new system, then that creates other types of conflicts that may not be known at the time, because there may be some unintended consequences of changing to that open work schedule that then creates other types of conflict that may be more difficult to resolve than the one that was listed. So maybe it's not a win-win. A conflict about testing arises in the college class. Due to sickness and other reasons, some students need to take exams on a makeup basis, but the instructor does not want to give the students any advantage over their peers and also doesn't want to go through the task of creating brand new tests for just a few people. That was certainly written by a teacher for sure. After working on the problem, the instructor and students arrive at a win-win solution. The instructor will hand out a list of 20 possible exam questions in advance. At the examination, 5 of these questions will be randomly drawn for the class to answer. Students who take makeup exams will draw from the same pool. In this way, makeup students are taking a fresh test without the instructor having to create a new exam. Yeah, that was written by an actual teacher. That is one conflict or dilemma that most teachers will have over their career of teaching for sure. Last one, I think, is the ideal one, or the best one to consider. I think it's a lot more real. It says a newly newly living together cohabitating peoples find themselves arguing frequently over their budget. Obviously, prior to the cohabitation, they did not discuss in detail or at length how their budget was going to work. So that is problem number one. So take a mental note, if not a real note, that prior to moving in with the people in an intimate, close relationship, especially romantic, make sure to discuss budgets, budget priorities, spending priorities, those kind of things. It says here that the one party enjoys buying impractical items, whereas the other party fears that such purchases will ruin their carefully constructed budget. But if it was carefully constructed, boy, that thing failed awful quick. So maybe it wasn't as carefully constructed as it should be. Just saying. It says their solution is to set aside a small amount of money each month for their fund purchases, which I think is a fantastic idea. That the amount is small enough to be affordable, yet it gives the one party that likes to indulge some area of freedom, and then the other party, who doesn't necessarily love the indulgence, is satisfied with the arrangement because the luxury money is now a budget category by itself, which gives that person the feeling that the things are under control. The plan works so well that the couple continues to use it even after their income rises by increasing the amount devoted to both the luxury category and the necessary livable expenses. So I would go dig a little deeper. If you would, go to the Google machine and take a look at the importance of creating strong financial plans, budget plans, and discuss spending and saving and budgeting with your shakaroony before you actually do decide to move into the same house, live in the same house, share the expenses of a place that two people want to call their own. So I do recommend you spending some time there because one of the number one reasons that whether it's shakaroonies or this old way of being in relationship, I don't know if you've heard of it before, but where people get married and stuff. And so I know it's an old thing. Hardly anyone does it, so it's kind of a weird concept. But most conflict, especially conflict that leads to a dissolution of a relationship, often is surrounds money and spending. And so if you want to kind of make sure that you give your relationships the best possible opportunity to succeed, find reasons, the main reasons why relationships dissolve and the main reasons for conflict within deep, intimate, romantic relationships, and then just work backwards. And so if there are children involved, normally it's usually in order of finances and children, and then some type of romantic, physical, sexual dysfunction between the parties. So normally those are the top three. So the top three reasons that people get divorced. I know it's an old concept because you have to get married first. But if you look at even divorce records from the 16th century, the 21st century. And usually the reason that people say they want to dissolve their relationship is that they have their, they don't, quote, love that person, whatever that means. And so that's one of the justifications, but they normally say that they have become incompatible or something like that. But if you break it down to the finer points, it's normally the incompatibility or their conflict or their inability to resolve conflict particularly has to do with finances, has to do with children, and has to do with sexual impropriety, cheating, unfaithfulness, or sexual dysfunction. So if you want to really have a deep, intimate, romantic, long-term relationship where both parties are living in the same place, then just work backwards. But to avoid conflict and to be able to manage conflict is good because once you get to the conflict stage where you have to resolve it, that is a bit more complicated. Okay, it says here at the end of this section which conflict style is best to use, Although the collaborative problem-solving may seem like the most attractive style, it's an oversimplification to imagine that there is a single best way to resolve conflicts. Generally speaking, a win-win approaches are preferable to win-lose or lose-lose. Duh, makes sense. But there are times when avoidance or accommodation and competition and compromise are appropriate. There's a really good chart on page 380, table 12.2. It says when to use each conflict style. And generally speaking, I think it's a pretty good chart there. Again, it doesn't give you the relationship type. So I'll give you three. Intimate, right? And that could be either romantic or family. And then you may have work, which is between an employee and then, again, a customer or consumer. And then you could go with work again between two employees. So if you look at those four contexts and you kind of overlay these conflict styles, you could probably make some sense out of it. But these conflict styles on that table are excellent because it says when to use them. But again, it's leaving out the type of relationship that it applies to. So again, if you're an employee and you have some type of conflict with a customer and you just avoid them, that could get you fired. So that's why, I mean, I like that chart, but it really does need a context. So at least think about the four that I mentioned. Intimate, which is divided into romantic and to familial, family. And then work is another context, right? And then we'll just say employee-to-employee conflict, right? Say someone steals your sandwich out of the refrigerator, you know? How do you resolve that? Versus if it is a employee and a customer, those kind of things. No, I don't mean a customer steals your sandwich out of the refrigerator. I just mean that in another type of conflict between an employee and a customer, these conflict styles, again, could be used. But we definitely need context. All right, so I'm going to end there for this second section, and there will be one more section coming up. So I'm ending on page 380. So this is Professor Tufano out.